Good day, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is 9/03/2002. Today's session is Manna and Mercy. Your presenter today is Tom Von Fischer. Let's listen in.
And welcome to all of you who've come this morning. It's a beautiful morning, and I'm sure some who thought it'd be a good idea to come to Bible study are meditating on the trail, on the hiking trail. And that's just fine. My name is Tom Von Fischer, and along with my wife Becky, we are co-pastors at Calvary Lutheran Church in South Minneapolis, in the urban congregation of the ELCA. How many of you are here in Bible study first time today? I recognize quite a few faces from yesterday. We've got a good group of new people, and welcome to you. Let's do what we did yesterday, which was kind of fun, and include you new folks in that. For how many of you is this your first time at Holden? Raise your hand. A lot of you, first time, a special welcome to you. How many of you have been here 10 times or more? Raise your hand. Look at that. You've got some veterans here. How many of you were here in the 70s, sometime during the 1970s? We've got about five of us. How many in the 60s? Oh, okay. How many in the 1960s? Raise your hand. Okay. What year?
Well,
we tried this yesterday, didn't we?
It was 68.
68. But I just want all the new timers to hear that, too, that there have been folks coming for many, many years and over here.
I'm not sure either, 63 or 64. 63, 64,
and for me it was 65. So I've only been here six times, although I know many people come almost every year. So to all of you, welcome. We're working our way through Manna and Mercy, which is a Bible study, the theme Bible study for this, the anniversary year, the 40th anniversary year of Holden Village. And it's entitled Manna and Mercy. If you've got a copy, I encourage people yesterday to go to the bookstore and buy one. Let's just hold up if you've got a copy. We'll get a sense of how many copies we've got. Okay, only about four. That's fine. Helps me know how we'll proceed this morning. Dan Erlander is the author of it. How many of you are familiar with it or have even done this Bible study? Okay, we've got, again, a few hands, mostly those of you who were here yesterday. Again, it just helps me know how to proceed. We're working our way through. We won't get through all of this week, but we're trying to work our way through as much as we can, and to allow both time for the presentation of the materials as well as give you a chance to interact with it. So grab a Bible on the way in, if you would, on the rack, and just come on in. Welcome. One of the things that Dan Erlander does that we have found fun, and we did yesterday, is his artwork. And so I'm just going to do a couple of the artwork pieces that we covered yesterday. He really starts from the beginning of creation and works his way through. The subtitle of the study is God's Plan for Mending the Entire Universe. So we've got a big long story, and excuse me, I'll sit through here. I'm going to be traveling this route a number of times throughout the morning, so we started with the creation story, but then we got to the story in Genesis about coming of sin, which Erlander talks about as a big deal, becoming a big deal. Let me just read to you a paragraph of how Erlander talks about sin as a big deal. God's celebration was disrupted when the earth creatures decided they could find joy in ways other than living as partners with God. And so humans decided to find joy by becoming big deals. Genesis 3:1-7, if you want to follow that. How did humans know if they were big deals? They knew by bossing other humans around, by piling up stuff, by dominating nature, by reaching glorious heights of health and beauty and knowledge. They also knew by having more points than other humans in their scoring system. See the guy in the middle keeping track? You know, our society and the world really is pretty good at that. We have more nuclear warheads. The Yankees have a higher payroll. You know, we keep track. We keep score of everything. There are more people in Minneapolis than most of the towns in Iowa. You know, Minnesota is better. You know how we do that. We all know how we do that, this thing of being a big deal. Then he goes on to say, humans gathered into groups, clans, tribes, and nations, and these collections of humans became extremely enthused about their group being better than other groups. And so humans invented oppression and war. And let's go to Dan's next drawing here. Oppression and war. Oppression involves setting up a system so one group can use another group for its own advantage. War involves killing humans in another group until they surrender. And war provides an obvious way to know which group is best. The winners are always the biggest deals. And Dan loves to have his little earth creatures, whether they're gophers or whatever, groundhogs there, and they are make these side comments. So, you know, they look at this war going on. They're a species God made an experiment, and the other one says, I'm not sure it's working. I'm not sure it's working. All right. Then we're going to jump ahead to the Exodus story. Again, these are biblical stories we know. I'm just trying to give you a flavor for how Erlander talks about it. And he talks about slavery in Egypt as kind of a quintessential big deal. So the God figure is Pharaoh, of course, at the top. And under the Pharaoh, then, is the royal family, and then the administrators and other big deals. This could be a corporate structure in the United States, huh? Then you got the ordinary citizens, farmers, traders, craftspeople, and then at the very bottom are the slaves, the Israelites, who are doing the work. And at the very bottom, some of you may be not able to see it, let me pull it up, the system of Pharaoh's Egypt. And so this is a big deal in Egypt, and notice now on the left, the status quo is preserved by two institutions, the priesthood, and on the right, the military. The priesthood are the ones that say, well, this is God's will, this is the way it is, the priest says, and the military, of course, enforces status quo through might and power, and there's a sense of eternalness about it. This is the way it is, and it's the way it always will be. And so this is the system in Egypt that God called Moses to lead the children of Israel out. And that leads us to what we talked about yesterday at some length called the Wilderness School. And I'll get this. And the Wilderness School was the 40 years out in the wilderness where God's people were learning about living as free people. You see today's lesson. So it's one thing to be freed. It's another thing to figure out now what does that mean. Remember, most of us remember when we left home, it was great to leave home. I have distinct memories of heading off to college. I'd had a wonderful home, but I was just delighted to be out of that little town in southwestern Minnesota and into a bigger world at St. Olaf College. It wasn't tremendously bigger in size, but it sure was bigger to me in terms of ideas and experiences and people from all over the United States. So learning to live as free people, and then we've got a few comments. Are we graded? No, it's pass fail. And here again are our two earth animals. They have to be taught how to live? You know, kind of an incredulity about this. I can't believe they have to be taught how to live. And then the wonderful comment, they're only human. Let's see, can you just, in the front of the machine, just turn it off. There's a switch all the way around the front. You got it? Just flip that. Okay, thank you. Put a quote on the board that maybe some of you saw when you came in. And as a summary of yesterday and at moving into today, I'd like us just to look at this. Walter Brueggemann is an Old Testament scholar, and he says, in regard to the wilderness, the gift of bread transforms the wilderness. And from that point on, Israel would entertain the thought that a place of perceived scarcity may turn out to be a place of wonderful abundance. I don't know if you can all see it. I want to read it again. It's a very profound quote, I think, and it really is summarizes for me what we talked about yesterday and launches us into today. The gift of bread. You know the story about manna in the wilderness, right? God gave everyone manna in the wilderness, And so they seem like they're without food. They're complaining bitterly. Here they've just come out of through the Red Sea and they're free. You would think they'd be forever happy, forever grateful. Some people say, you know, if God would demonstrate God's power more regularly, more people would believe. I say, you don't know the biblical story, because one of the central miracles of the Old Testament, the Exodus, happens, and within a matter of days, they're grumbling. We want to go back to Egypt. So the gift of bread, now being given manna every day, transforms this 40 years of the wilderness journey. And Brueggemann says, from that point on, Israel would entertain the thought, and here's the thought, a place of perceived scarcity, in other words, where there's hardly anything, could be a place of wonderful abundance. I'll tell you a quick story. In 1995, our family, by invitation of a former intern of mine from Tanzania, went to Tanzania, Africa, for his ordination. Our daughter at that point was 17 years old, and she's adopted. She's African-American, biracial actually, but perceived to be African-American. And this was a big deal for Kristen, our daughter, to be able to go to see Africa, her roots, her part of where her lineage comes from. We got to Tanzania. I don't know if any of you have been to Africa or Tanzania. It's incredibly poverty-stricken. Tanzania is one of the poorest countries in the world. And we went from village to village visiting family members of our intern. And Kristen, after a while, said to me, "This is just awful. These people have nothing." And I said, "Really?" And then she caught herself and she said, "I think they've got everything. Family, faith, a sense of God's presence in all of life." And it was a tremendous aha moment for our daughter, where she realized the wonderful abundance, not counted in ways that we like to count, keeping score, right? Big deals. I have 17 shirts in my closet and 42 pairs of shoes. You know how we tend to count our accumulations, our house, our cars. So that this, I think for me, this quote from Brueggemann says, a place of perceived scarcity may turn out to be a place of wonderful abundance. I hope that your time here at Holden, especially for those of you who are first-timers, might be an experience of perceived scarcity. There's not much here that we're used to. TVs aren't here, phones, etc., etc. But we hope it will be a time of wonderful abundance for you. Any other reflections on that quote or experiences? I want to give you a chance to interact from time to time as we go.
Well, I think where the Israelis are right now is not a really neat place to go to when they started there.
Right. Okay. Other comments?
But on the rest of God's decision to give them freedom is not, we carry that today. Anything is foreign to what we're used to.
Right.
Change we don't like.
That's right.
Even though we think we're progressing.
Yeah. It's always a stretch for us. Holden is a stretch for us intentionally to leave all those trappings behind and come to a place of perceived scarcity. Can't have our favorite diet, can't have this, can't have that, can't do this, can't do that. A perceived scarcity, but this has been a place of wonderful abundance. Okay, let's move, and I've got a few extra copies from the library of this, and we're going to do a fair amount of reading today. And who are some people who have good voices? Can you all hear me okay? Mm-hmm. I'm aware we have some people with hearing issues, so I'm trying to project. I'd like for, in addition to those who already have copies of the book, maybe three other people who wouldn't mind doing some reading from time to time. There are a couple in the back. If you can just slide those back. One other volunteer? Okay, thank you. I'll do a fair amount of the reading, and then we're just going to pause, and I want you to feel free at any point to interrupt, and we'll engage that question, and if we want to continue that question, we may do so afterwards, in order that we can kind of keep moving through this material, which is really very, very wonderful material. Those of you who have the books, turn to page 9. This is the final summary now of yesterday. The Wilderness School.
I'll pull us back down, but we won't.
Yeah, turn that back on. So here is Erlander's summary of what the children of Israel learned in their wilderness school. And I invite you just to close your eyes. And I'm going to read this slowly. And I invite you to ask yourself the question, have I learned this lesson in my life? What the children of Israel were learning in their wilderness school. Number one, we own nothing. All is God's. All is God's gift. Lesson number two. God gives enough for all to be shared by all. God gives enough for all to be shared by all. Have we learned that lesson? Lesson number three. This is in regard to the manna. Hoarding causes rot. It stinks. Lesson number four. Work is helping God distribute manna, the gift God promises to all. Once again, work is helping God to distribute the manna, the gift which God promises to all. And the final lesson is a Sabbath lesson. God gives rest so humans can practice full time what life is all about, namely friendship with God, friendship with others, friendship with nature. Okay, now we're going to move into our work. We're talking about getting ready for the Promised Land. Children of Israel are on the brink. They are completing or nearing the end of their wilderness school, their journey of 40 years. And chapter 4 now, those of you that have the book, I'm on page 10, is entitled The Covenant and the Covenant Gift. God promised to bring the wilderness people to another form of manna called land. Now think for a moment. They've come through thinking about manna as just something you put in your mouth. And it's provided day by day, just enough. And now we're moving into a new place, the Promised Land. And Erlander says, the new form of manna isn't stuff you put in your mouth, but it is that which provides the food to put in your mouth. Are you with me? It's the land. The old proverb says, you can give a man a fish or you can teach him how to fish. God is teaching the children of Israel now how to move into a land, take the land and till it in order to provide manna for themselves and for all. This land would be home. Here they would plow and plant and harvest. Here they would raise their children, keep the Sabbath, and celebrate the great festivals. Yahweh, and throughout, Erlander uses the Hebrew word for God, Yahweh. Yahweh was glad, but Yahweh was also worried about the day when this promise would come true. Often in the Old Testament, God is pictured in very human terms as responding, reacting, having doubts, wondering about this, wondering about that. We know that God is God, but the Old Testament writers wrote about God in very human kinds of ways. So they picture, the Old Testament pictures Yahweh as glad, but also worried about the day when this promise would come true. And here are God's questions. Would a landed people become like Pharaoh's Egypt? With big deals and little deals, big landowners and those with very little land, rich and poor, would the new promised land soon have oppressed and oppressors? Yahweh brooded and brooded and then came up with a plan. I will bind myself to this people in a covenant partnership. We will be attached to each other. We will be lovers. We will be partners. We will be friends forever. you know, the wedding ceremony, where it comes to that point, we bind to each other, bind oneself to each other. This is the same kind of covenant promise that God is making now, planning to make with God's people. There are some Old Testament scholars who will say this whole idea of covenant is one of the key issues in the Old Testament. And if you want to understand the Old Testament at all, you need to understand the nature of covenant. So we're going to spend some time on that. What a day it was when the covenant-making ceremony took place at a mountain called Sinai. It was like a grand wedding. In the midst of lightning, thunder, smoke, and trumpet sounds, God made a covenant promise. I'm going to put a different drawing on here now. Erlander does all his artwork, I understand. I've never met him. He's coming up here at the end of this month for a conference, but I'm looking forward to that because we'll still be here. But I understand that he does all his own artwork in the book, which is just really wonderful. Okay, so in the midst of lightning and thunder and smoke and trumpet sounds, God made the covenant promise. Yahweh would be this people's God, would adopt them as a holy nation. In deep gratitude, the people would love God alone with their heart and soul and strength. All right, now take your Bibles and turn to Exodus chapter 19, verses 1 to 8. Exodus chapter 19, verses 1 to 8. Someone with a good loud voice can read that for us. We have a variety of translations, I know, but this is, most of us, I think, have New Revised Standard, and that should enable us to follow along simply. Someone read that, please. Exodus 19, verses 1 to 8.
On the third new moon, after the Israelites had gone out of the land of Egypt, on that very day they came into the wilderness of Sinai. They had journeyed from Rephidim, entered the wilderness of Sinai, and camped in the wilderness. Israel camped there in front of the mountain. And Moses went up to God. The Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the Israelites, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possessions out of all the peoples. Indeed, the whole earth is mine, but you shall be for me a priestly kingdom and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the Israelites." So Moses came, some of the elders of the people, and set before them all these words that the Lord had commanded him. The people all answered as one, "Everything that the Lord has spoken, we will do." Moses reported the words of the people to the Lord. Then the Lord said to Moses, "I am going to come to you in a dense cloud in order that the people may hear when I speak with you and so trust you ever after."
Thank you. Notice the way Erlander pictures what God gives Moses for the people.
Gift.
Gift. It's a wrapped package. And this is a very intentional piece of artwork on his part, because Erlander wants to emphasize the goodness of God and that what God has given us is really a gift for liberation, for freeing us, rather than a bunch of rules that will curb our worst things about us. So, and the gift at this point now is specifically the gift of the land, that they're coming into the new promised land and being given the gift of the land. All right, I'm going to let someone else now read from the book. Starting at the bottom of page 10, the last three lines the people sensed, and go on the top of the next page.
On that special day, God gave the partner people a beautiful gift, the covenant word. The gift described the blessed way the people would live because God loved them, liberated them, and promised to be their God. The gift showed them how to live as a joyful man of people on the land. The leaders of Israel went up to the mountain and gazed upon Yahweh without dying. They ate and drank to celebrate their household moving to a new home. The people sensed that this was one of the greatest days since the world was created. The stars danced and creation joined the angels in a great hymn of joy, God and the former slave people had bonded themselves to each other in covenant partnership. The people received the beautiful covenant gift with thanksgiving and called it Torah. They willingly embraced the way of life described in the Torah, calling it the way of blessedness and health and peace. The partner people especially loved the opening words in the Torah, which they called the Decalogue.
Thank you. The Decalogue, again, now Erlander has taken and put it into his words, the Ten Commandments. And you see, dear partners, I'm not sure if all of you can see the screen well, so I'll just read it. Dear partners, I chose you and liberated you. Therefore, I'm going to just write that word up here because we want to come back to that. The therefore, it is, begins with the reminder of what God has done, choosing us and liberating us. Therefore, you will trust only me. You will bring honor to my name. You will keep the Sabbath. Continued on next tablet. You know how it's normally depicted, the first three commandments on the first tablet and the other seven on the second. So continued on the next tablet. And when you are tempted to follow the way of Egypt or the way of the people around you, you will refuse. You will honor your parents. You will not kill. You will not run after another's spouse. You will not steal or deceive. And you will not covet your neighbor's manna. Love God. Exodus 21:17. And then the comments of the people is kind of interesting. How I love your law, O Yahweh. Over here the people are commenting. And here, I will ponder it day and night. And these are words from a couple of the Psalms. Because the people, again, you remember the previous diagram, received it not as, oh no, you got to do all that, but it was a wonderful gift. How many of you grew up in the church feeling that the Ten Commandments were a wonderful gift rather than, can't do that. It says so right here. Third commandment, second commandment, eighth commandment.
Always thou shalt.
Always thou shalt and thou shalt not. Yeah. And that's really a very different spirit than the way in which Erlander is presenting it and the way, you know, he's convinced, and many of us are, that it was intended. We got things turned around a little bit. We got it figured or taught to us that if we were good, if we obeyed the Ten Commandments, that would be in order that God would love us. In order that, the pastor would say, you're a good boy, you're a good girl. In order that, we would get to heaven. In order that, it was conditional. This really, we just have to say, is not the way the Old Testament story is told. It's beginning back here. I chose you and liberated you, therefore. Because of what God has done, we receive these commands as life-giving. And think again, they're coming out of Egypt, we're into a new place. And it's not unlike saying to a four-year-old boy, well, I'm going to take off and go to work now, have a good day, and I'll see you when I get home. A four-year-old, a six-year-old, you know, is not equipped to be on his own, right? And so what's going on in the wilderness school and leading into the promised land is God's guidance, his gift of love, which is going to prepare them then for their new life. I think we'll just move on here. I know we're going to be just short of time, so we're going to try to jump around a little bit. There's some very interesting stuff in Deuteronomy chapter 14. I invite you to turn to that now. Deuteronomy chapter 14, verses 22 to 26. I invite someone to read that. Now, these are going to be some examples of the many ways God was teaching them to practice manna living. And this is something to do with the tithe or how they were to do their crops. And so if someone can read us Deuteronomy 14, 22 to 26.
Be sure to set aside a tenth of all that your fields produce each year. Eat the tithe of your grain, new wine and oil, and the firstborn of your herds and flocks in the presence of the Lord your God, at the place he will choose as a dwelling for his name, so that you may learn to revere the Lord your God always. But if that place is too distant, and you have been blessed by the Lord your God, and cannot carry your tithe, because the place where the Lord will choose to put his name so far away, then exchange your tithe for silver, and take the silver with you, and go to the place the Lord your God will choose. How far are we supposed to read here?
26.
Use the silver to buy whatever you like, cattle, sheep, wine, or other fermented drink, or anything you wish. Then you and your household shall eat there in the presence of the Lord your God, and rejoice.
Thank you. Okay, so when the partner people now are given the gift of land and they start harvesting their crops, they are told to give the first and the best tenth of their crops to God. This is the biblical concept of the tithe. And they do this in order to remember one of their wilderness school learnings, which was, all belongs to God. The land wasn't given to me, myself, and I and my family. It was a loan. It belongs to God, and it's loaned to me and my family. For 2 years out of three, God will give the tenth back to the people for a great feast. And during this feast, the family will know that God gives and gives. You see, what's happening is this wonderful joy of giving. We all know it, don't we? It's so much fun to give to someone you love. So we receive this gift to us, we give it back, and God gives it back to us. Have you experienced some of that joy? I think many people have. The joy of giving, and then it somehow comes back to us over and over again. They will know that Yahweh wants humans to enjoy the bounty of the earth. God loves feasting, but does not want, if you've got a book and want to follow, I'm on page 12 now. God loves feasting, but does not want some to feast while others grow hungry. This would disrupt the joyful manna balance. No one with too much, no one with too little. Therefore, every third of the year, the people with, and here's the Hebrew word, nahala, it's a land inheritance. This is the Hebrew word for being given the land. And in the Torah's view, or in the Old Testament view of land ownership, as we said already, all land is owned by God. It's held in perpetuity by a family. So we give it to Connie and Jean and say, this is not yours. Don't put your name on it, Sorensen. It's God's name on it, but you have it forever in perpetuity. And you pass it on to your children and your grandchildren, and it stays in the family. This is the Old Testament concept of Nahala. And it was to sustain life, and the excess going to the widows, the orphans, the sojourners, and the priests. And it was inconceivable to sell the land since you didn't own it anyway, right? It belongs to God. So you see now in the diagram, the child says to the father, why don't we cut all the way up to the walls? Here are the walls of their property, and you see some of it's been cut, but here on the edges, some of the grain is not cut. And the father says, we take only what we need. The rest is for the poor. And the little boy says, when I grow up, I'm going to keep the covenant just like my grandpa. So there is this wonderful vision of you don't take all that's given to you, but you reserve that for who? For the poor, the orphans, the widows, the priests, the sojourners. I grew up in a parsonage family. My dad and grandfather were paid very little, but we lived in southern rural Minnesota. This is probably true for many of you in Iowa. And part of the preacher's pay was the farmers brought produce in. So I'm an only child. I remember vividly the door, there'd be a knock at the door, and some farmer, member of the congregation, would have eggs, would have chickens, once in a while would bring hamburger or steak. They provided, in very much the spirit of this Old Testament law, providing for the clergy. So there was very little cash salary. The house was provided, the parsonage, and a lot of the food was provided. Well, those are a couple of our largest expenses, are they not? And so this was the way in which the people cared for the pastor in much this biblical sense. And again, this is a grateful response of a liberated people. Okay, the covenant gift provided other ways to maintain a man of balance. The partner people will not cut their crops all the way to the walls, as the diagram shows. Neither will they cut it for a second time or pick up what falls. What is not cut or not picked up will feed the poor and the sojourners. And thus the people will remember that God owns all and God's manna is for all. The partner people will take only what they need, as they did in the wilderness. Now turn to Leviticus, third book of the Bible, Old Testament. Leviticus 19, verses 9 and 10. I'm just going to call these out and let you read them for yourself. Leviticus 19, 9 and 10. And then also in Leviticus chapter 23, verse 22. And then go to Deuteronomy 24, 19 through 22. Deuteronomy 24, 19 to 22. And then we'll just pause for a little discussion if anyone wants to raise any points of question or comment. Okay, any comments or questions over here?
If the land user is not to cut to the wall, is not to cut a second time, or is not to pick up the grain that is for sojourners and widows and people in need, how is the grain moved to the people in need?
You all get the question, how if we aren't to cut to the walls, if you aren't to cut a second time, the distribution question he's asking, how does it get to the people who need it? I don't really know the answer to that question in the biblical times. I don't know if anyone else does, whether there was a system in place where others would then come and do that, because clearly some orphans or widows wouldn't be able to do it by themselves. But there was clearly within villages or clans a way in which that was done. There was a distribution system that enabled it. But maybe some others who've studied this, go ahead.
When you started these passages, I thought about Ruth. She's a very famous gleaner, and I see you have that in the book.
Right.
After a while. Yeah. I suppose it was in every community that poor people at harvest time would go out and glean.
Yeah, they're clear. It was a system that worked, because that was the nature of a man of society. He cared for everyone. That was the power of this whole thing of the man who came and was lost, that we commemorated last night, that he was so much more cared for here in this setting than he was as a homeless person on the streets of Seattle. So in a smaller community like this, we have the ability to care for all of our members, and that clearly was the sense. So the challenge for us today to create a man of society where all the needs are met is just an enormous distribution. How do we do that? How do we get the resources to the people who need it? Other comments or questions?
Unfortunately, in today's society, and I hear this all the time, that the farmer, for example, may make the offer to a local food bank and say, there's this part of our fields I'll leave. And they'll say, well, if you bring it to us, we'll be glad to have it. But we don't want to bother coming out together.
The translation is huge, to take what is a wonderful biblical concept and translate it into our current context. That's course, Martin Luther's big question, what does this mean, is the toughest question for us always. Yes.
Well, we have this situation where we as a nation send many food items to other countries in need, and the bureaucracies there waylay it and take out their cut, and it doesn't get to the need.
Yeah. We're back to the picture of Pharaoh in Egypt, you know.
Yes.
We send it for the people down here, and it comes off on the top. Okay, I want to keep moving. And the next portion of... and I tried to copy this whole page because it's a very key part of this lesson, and I'll just read it for you. And to the degree you can see the screen, you can follow along. Now, God is wondering, would the partner people remain faithful to the covenant life, and would they continue to live the manna way? If they were to remain faithful, Yahweh knew they would have to hold two qualities in balance. And now we've got, Erlander's done a nice job of putting these two things with a ring or something, holding them together. They're two quite different realities, but we've got to find a way in a manna society to hold them together. On the left is the concept, the biblical concept of righteousness, which is following the words of the covenant gift, the Holy Torah, which describes the manna life, the just way to live together. We would say this is the commandments, this is the law, this is the way God intended it to be, all right? On the other side is mercy, which is practicing compassion toward the most vulnerable in society, the widows, the orphans, the sojourners, is the biblical language. And now I'm continuing down here. Maybe I'll scoot this up a little.
Can you pull it up toward you?
I'll just bring it up a little higher than I think everybody can see it if it's up a little higher.
Good, thank you.
Okay, so Yahweh understood that righteousness without mercy leads to grumpy legalism. You get that? If we push it down just a little bit so I can point. There you go. So if we cut off the mercy, if there's no compassion and you're only in this world, what have you got? You've got a grumpy legalist. You're wrong. You didn't do that right. Uh-uh. You know, you're always pointing fingers at others who aren't doing things right. We know people like that, don't we? In our families. We know that about ourselves. That when you only have righteousness without mercy, you have a grumpy legalist on your hand. However, the other flip side of the coin, mercy without righteousness, is wishy-washy sentimentalism. Do whatever you want to do, that's fine. Anything goes. So if you eliminate righteousness and only practice compassion, there's no heart to it. There's no gut to it. What God intended is not part of it. So the lover God wondered, how can the people be helped to hold these two in balance? How can they be deepened, enriched, and renewed in the life of righteousness and mercy? And after thinking and thinking, Yahweh decided to give the beloved people one more gift. The gift of worship. Thank you, keep pulling up. So worship now becomes the way that God is going to help us keep righteousness and mercy together. And he talks about it as a joyful activity when the partner people will confess God's holy name, will ascribe absolute worth to God and to God alone. And this is what's called the Shema, and turn in your Bibles to Deuteronomy. Well, you don't have to because it's right here. Deuteronomy 6. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one God. Yahweh your God is one God. Jewish people say this every day. And you shall love Yahweh your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. Probably the most quoted passage of the Bible, especially because that is the heart of the Jewish creed. The word Shema in Hebrew is the word to hear. Hear, oh, it's just that kind of constant reminder. Okay, now I'll continue on the top of page 15 for those of you in the book. Worship will also be a special time to remember, to retell, and give thanks for Yahweh's saving acts of history, in history. Those times when the lover God practiced righteousness and mercy in awesome ways, especially the great liberation from Pharaoh's Egypt. And by worshiping, the people incorporate themselves into the life of God by confessing the Shema, the Hear, O Israel, by telling the stories of God, by sharing the meal, which remembers the Exodus, and by offering thanksgiving, the people will immerse themselves more deeply into the life of God, into partnership with God. And this relationship will empower the community to act as God acts in righteousness and mercy. Okay? Let me say just a word about this concept of remembering. When in our culture, when we say, do you remember? It leads many of us to say no, and I think I'm in the early stages of Alzheimer's, right? We forget. We can't call many things we can't call to mind anymore. It's a very different sense in the biblical word, remember. It means to pull something of the past into the present and make it a reality. It's those times I can remember when my grandfather would talk about what life was like in Germany before, as a teenager, he was called or sent to this country to be a pastor. And he told it in such vivid ways, I felt like I was there. Are you with me? Sometimes a storyteller can do that, can tell a story from the past in such a dramatic way, you feel like you're there. That's the sense of remembrance in the Old Testament. And that's the very same sense for us in the Lord's Supper, so that when we receive that piece of bread and that sip of wine, it isn't just to remember the Last Supper, it is to experience that, the gift of forgiveness and the gift of being in covenant with God that was part of that gift of the Last Supper. It also, remember, also comes from the future into the present. So it draws the promises of God in the future into the present and makes them real, makes them absolutely as though they are now. Very often at a funeral, when we are not just weeping and grieving the loss, the death of a loved one, but thinking what it is that their life now is, and we speak of it as being with God in heaven, that we take that future gift and bring it into our lives. So we are happy for our loved ones. We're happy for ourselves because we draw the hope and the promise of the future into the present. I don't know if I'm explaining that well. Some of you have probably dealt with the concept before, but it's a very, very important concept of the scriptures, that when we say remember, when God says remember the covenant, it's not like, how's your history lesson? Do you remember what I told you back on such and such a day? No, it's to take that reality of the past, bring it into the present. Yes?
Part of our native culture is our stories and our legends are told over and over, similar to the biblical text, right? That when our stories and legends that are ways of living righteously, right, in our native background, that we retell the story over and over again.
Did y'all hear that? When you tell a story over and over, then you live that way.
You
right?
live that way. You're ingrained with that knowledge, right. Right. Similar to the text of the Bible. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Any other comments?
Gary went in his, the Bible study he developed, talks about this very same thing, that when the Jewish people remember, they were part of the Exodus. They were there. But even today, I mean, that's very much with them at this moment.
That's right. Yeah. When we keep that history so alive, then it's part of who we are. It's right. Not an appendage, it's not something we forget about, but it's right before we came up, my wife and I are on a 3-month sabbatical. In the first week, we had a family reunion in Leavenworth, Washington, and both my grandfathers were sent to this country as missionaries from Germany. And my grandpa Ricky came to Washington before it was a state, but it was still a territory. And now that family is, 262 descendants of Grandpa Ricky. One of the descendants is Mary Schramm, whom some of you know, whose husband John Schramm was director here back in the 70s and early 80s. And so we're out of that same family. And we don't tend to be a family that gets together often, about every 10, 15 years. But when we do, it's a lot of telling the stories about Grandpa and those early generations, because we're always fearful that our children don't know those stories. Of course, we say of the scriptures that Christianity is always one generation from extinction, because if we stop telling the story and we stop living the story in an increasingly secular world, if we stop living the story, then it will die. So the importance of taking these rich biblical stories and not just telling them but living them out is at the very heart of passing on the faith from generation to generation. Okay, we'll move. We only have 10 minutes left. We aren't going to get real far into the next section, but we want to at least get a start. Some people who are, I think, here again today or here yesterday talked about having experienced Dan Erlander's teaching, a very soft-spoken, gentle person with a wonderful sense of humor. And of course now here we have Moses giving his farewell speech on the this sea looks dead for obvious reasons, the salt content. Sea of Galilee up here in the River Jordan on the edge of the Promised Land. So what we have now, well, let me just read the text, because Erlander does a better job than I can if I try to. After many years in the wilderness school and failing many exams, God's people were ready for graduation, which is entry into the land where they would live the way they had learned in the wilderness. So as they approached the boundary, God's heart was glad. God believed that these people would live differently from all other nations. God dreamed of the result. All the nations on earth, attracted by the witness of these people, would gather to learn about the manna way, God and humans and nature living together in peace. God looked at planet Earth and cried out, "There is hope. My dream will come true. My promise is unfolding." The graduation ceremony took place at the boundary on the east side of the Jordan River, and Moses delivered a powerful commencement address. It's in Deuteronomy, the first part of it's in Deuteronomy chapter 1. And he reminded the people of God's wonderful acts on their behalf. He pleaded with the people to remember God's love and the lessons God had taught them. Moses urged them to respond by living as a wilderness people when they received the gift of the land. And he also told the covenant people these words. 1. When you follow the way of righteousness and mercy, you will bring blessings and happiness to yourself and to your society, and then you will choose life, and you and your children will live. Turn to your Bible in Deuteronomy chapter 30. Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 15 and 16. Someone read that for us.
See, I have set before you today life and prosperity, death and adversity. If you obey the commandments of the Lord your God that I am commanding you today, by loving the Lord your God, walking in his ways, and observing his commandments, decrees, and ordinances, then you shall live and become numerous, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land that you are entering to possess.
Okay. That's the first point. The counterpoint is in verse 17 through 20, and if you would just continue reading that, verse continuing 17 through 20.
But if your heart turns away and you do not hear, but are led astray to bow down to other gods and serve them, I declare to you today that you shall perish. You shall not live long in the land that you are crossing the Jordan to enter and possess. I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses. Choose life so that you and your descendants may live, loving the Lord your God, obeying him, and holding fast to him. For that means life to you and length of days, so that you may live in the land that the Lord swore to give to your ancestors, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob.
Thank you. Here's the footnote Erlander puts to this passage. The blessing and curse that we just heard about Deuteronomy are often misinterpreted, he maintains, to mean God rewards me when I am good, and God punishes me when I am bad. An appropriate interpretation would be, Erlander says, a community which lives a shalom way, or a manly way, brings health to itself. And a community which does not practice righteousness and mercy brings sickness to itself. How do you respond to that? It's the difference between an individual approach, if I'm good, God blesses me, if I'm bad, God punishes me, as opposed to the community of which I'm a part, is when we live in a whole kind of way, as we try to do here at Holden, it brings blessings upon people like Doug, right? That we were saying last night. And when we don't live in a whole community, then we bring illness upon ourselves. There was a hand in the back. Sorry. Anyone want to respond to this?
It's kind of like the harder I work, the luckier I get. Puts it in your court.
I think we need to know, when we look at the world today, most societies perceive that this phenomenon has a lot of meaning, because very few societies live this way. And we see, all you have to do is pick up the morning paper, right? And all of the view is gloom, doom, and despair everywhere. Very discouraging.
Very discouraging. The rest, as we move through the next couple days now, if you need to leave here feeling good, don't come. It gets really tough the next couple days, because the Old Testament story and the early New Testament story is very tough. Very tough. And how we fail to learn the lessons that they learned in the wilderness school. And now things just start to come unraveled in the Old Testament days. And we have lots to learn from that, because there are many, many differences, of course, but also many parallels, and always kind of coming back to what did we learn in the wilderness school. So I want to just, if you could turn that off
again for me.
I want to just end again by returning to this quote. Entertaining the thought, whether the gift of bread that transforms the wilderness, it gives us the possibility of thinking that a place of perceived scarcity may turn out to be a place of wonderful abundance. Let's just end by naming some of the things in our experience that are of wonderful abundance, that things that are qualities of life that define for us an abundant life. Can I just call some out?
Community.
Community.
Family.
Family.
Water.
Holden Village. Mm-hmm. Mutual support.
Church.
Charitable organizations.
Prayer.
Work.
Love.
Laughter.
Nature.
Compassion.
Education.
Let's close our time with a word of prayer. You have heard from our lips, O God, that which we claim as part of the abundant life. During our hours and days here at Holden Village, we pray that you might nurture those gifts deep within our soul, so that when it comes time for us to climb on the bus and head back out, we might be a renewed and transformed people, willing and able, schooled by you in the wilderness, to return to our daily lives and bring that life, your life, into the places where we live. Bless now this day as a gift from you to each other. For your name's sake we pray. Amen. Thank you for coming. It's time for coffee. For those of you who are new, head up to the dining hall and grab a cup of coffee and some of the bacon.